there are lots of schools with 15 or 20 kids in them. Yeah, those are expensive to run.
A funding proposal from the legislature could force small schools in the state to close. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, March 31st. Good evening, I'm Zachariah Hughes. Also tonight, balancing the fishing life and family life.
It's like the days are long, but the years go by fast. And then when your kids are adults, they're thankful that they know how to work hard.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
When you pick Click Give, you become a partner with a local nonprofit working to protect the things you love about Alaska. Whether it's the arts, our parks, or lending a hand to someone in crisis, with Pick Click Give, it's easy to find a nonprofit that shares your passion or provides programs in your neighborhood. When you apply for your PFD, say yes to sharing just $25 or more of your dividend. If you've already filed, add a donation at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by Pick Click Give.
A funding provision in a broad education reform bill has school administrators across the state worried, especially in smaller districts. The proposal from Republican Senator Shelley Hughes would limit funding for schools operating below 80% capacity. KTOO's Caroline Halter reports.
Juneau School District Superintendent Mark Miller is one of many administrators unhappy with the school size funding provision in Senate Bill 96.
That would force districts like ours, potentially, to have to shut down schools and bus the kids across town.
The Juneau Empire reported 7 out of the district's 10 traditional schools operated below 80% capacity in 2016. Miller's staff calculated what the change would mean in dollar terms.
It would be a significant hit to our budget over the long run, about $4 million.
That loss would occur over a 10-year period. Districts could be facing additional cuts. Senate Republicans said they will reduce public education funding by 5% in their budget proposal. Prior to the release of Senate Bill 96, Hughes pointed out in an interview that Alaska has the highest per-student expenditures in education, yet outcomes continue to disappoint. Her goal is to reduce administrative costs and boost outcomes at the same time. Miller doesn't think that comparing Alaska to other states makes a lot of sense in this context.
Is education in Alaska expensive? Yes, education in Alaska is expensive. So are the hamburgers. Getting things here is expensive, and we are so spread out that there are lots of schools with 15 or 20 kids in them. Yeah, those are expensive to run.
Hughes' bill caters to rural areas by exempting schools that are further than 25 miles driving distance of another school from the 80% rule. Representative Harriet Drummond chairs the Education Committee in the House.
There are some good provisions in SB 96, but the, you know, the thing that I know that is bothering most people is the school size factor piece. And that needs to be addressed separately from all of these other education issues.
She's not opposed to changing the school funding formula, but thinks it will take much longer than the 2 weeks legislators have left before the end of session.
It needs to be addressed slowly and thoughtfully and not squeezed out of a legislature at the last minute. And I'm not going to push it out of my committee, that's for sure.
Drummond said she reached out to Senator Hughes to work on this issue during the interim. For now, the bill remains in the Senate Education Committee, where it has already had 7 hearings since its first reading on March 20th. In Juneau, I'm Caroline Halter.
Southeast Alaska's largest tribal court operation just celebrated its 10th anniversary. It started with child support and paternity cases and branched out to include domestic violence protection orders, custody disputes, and adoptions. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld paid a visit to the court and filed this report.
All right, this is March 30th, 2017. We are here in case number 2015 FAM.
Presiding Judge Deborah O'Gara begins a hearing in the Central Council of Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska's courtroom. It's a custody case, and the one parent attending sits at a table answering questions while a clerk takes notes. O'Gara explains the other parent is out of state and can't attend.
Because of the relocation and through no fault of anybody's, they were not able to make arrangements for her to appear on phone.
The short hearing follows a set procedure, but is less formal than state or federal courts. O'Gara sits at the bench and wears a black robe. Both are decorated with the council's Eagle Raven Formline Design logo. She says the Juneau-based court has between 900 and 1,000 open cases. They involve some of the council's approximately 30,000 members in Southeast, the rest of Alaska, the Pacific Northwest, and elsewhere.
We firmly believe that tribal members are more likely to come into court when the court is their own tribal court, and it's their own tribal laws that are being implemented.
The Central Council Tribal Assembly authorized the court in 1989, but it took a while before operations began. It started out handling a short list of cases and related services, but that's expanded with grants, interagency agreements, and new ideas. One major focus is developing systems for young offenders, as well as those at risk of getting into trouble. That includes an early diversion program, which offers counseling and tutoring while encouraging involvement with extended family and cultural activities.
If we don't intervene early, the youth are more likely to end up committing crimes or getting into trouble and getting into the justice system.
About a year ago, the Central Council signed an agreement with the state, giving it authority over some foster care and other services for Native children facing abuse or neglect. Council Director of Family and Youth Services, Francine Eddy Jones, says only a few cases have been transferred so far, but they have potential.
They're coming into tribal court, but they're also seeing familiar faces in terms of tribal caseworkers working with them to identify what they need to be working on. And our goal is always to support the families and see if we can move towards reunification.
The National Council of Juvenile and Family Court Judges is supporting the Tribal Justice Program. It recently chose Tlingit Haida's court as one of six nationwide to be studied and given expert advice. O'Gara says the scrutiny will help.
It's not any funding, but what we get is we get them to come out. They're going to look at our system, they're going to look at our codes, they're going to meet our staff, they're going to look at our procedures.
A team visited in February, and its report is expected soon. About 85% of the tribal court's cases involve child support, but it has plans for further expansion. If funding becomes available, O'Gara says it will begin taking some criminal cases. Central Council President Richard Peterson says those found at fault will be held accountable.
We're not trying to get some free pass for people, but we're trying to make it so that they are passionately enough that they're given a chance to right their wrongs.
O'Gara says there's already an agreement with the state court system to make sentencing recommendations in some cases involving tribal members. She says she hopes to begin what's called circle sentencing soon, but cultural programs and other support services need to be put in place first. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Ed Schoenfeld.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, teaching Turkish belly dance on the last frontier.
Omuz atma, meaning, you know, shoulder shimmy, or it's the accent, shoulder accent.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. And by
Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com.
A 14-year-old Juneau High School student was honored by the governor's office today for rescuing a 5-year-old boy that he saw fall into a fast-running creek. KTOO's Jacob Resnick reports.
Juneau Douglas High School sophomore Seth Guerin was one of four friends hanging out at Cope Park on Wednesday at about 6 p.m. Guerin said some small children and an adult walked up the path. Then a small boy in the group was walking near the fast-running water when he lost his footing.
He started to slide down, and there was a fence and a tree there, and it looked like he was going to stop himself. My friend Xavier tried to grab him. He fell off. Riley jumped in the water, grabbed him, handed him to me. We carried him up to the ambulance. I made sure he was okay, and we left.
His friend Riley is 14-year-old Yakus Dakahiti High School student Ayasafa Riley John. Authorities say the young man's quick thinking and fast acting likely saved the life of 5-year-old Mason Varner from drowning in the fast-moving creek. Riley John was honored Friday afternoon by Juneau Police, rescuers, and Lieutenant Governor Byron Mallott, who presented an award from the governor's office.
We never say, son or daughter, we want you to perform an act of selfless courage that might put you in harm's way. And somehow, it was there in this young man.
5-year-old Mason Varner attended and appeared to be in good spirits as his visibly moved mother clung to him during the short ceremony. Riley John spoke only briefly to thank everyone and to clarify that his friend Seth Guerin also deserved to be recognized for helping him get the boy to safety. In Juneau, I'm Jacob Resnick.
Iris Nash fell in love with fishing her very first day out on the water. She loved it so much that she married a fisherman. The two started working together a few years ago and now run their own boat in Sitka.
I find myself constantly identifying as being a fisherman and then realigning myself and being like, well, I don't really do a whole lot of money making anymore. I haven't really pulled a whole lot of fish in the last year.
That's because Iris is a new mother. Her son turns 2 this year, and she's pregnant with another. To answer some of her questions about balancing being a mom and co-managing a fishing business, KCAW's Emily Russell connected Iris with Sarah Jordan. Sarah also married into a fishing family and raised her own 2 sons aboard the family boat.
When your kids were old enough to be all out on the boat with you, what did you do to keep them entertained?
Well, at the point that there were 2 of them, they always played together, you know. Aww. Although sometimes it would start out fun wrestling, and then the boat would lurch and someone's head would smack into something, and then they would be crying and I'd have to separate them. Or we had to have this no wrestling rule, which they didn't like, and I'd say, hey, if I have to separate you, somebody's going in the forecastle and somebody's going on the back deck, and it's raining, so you don't want to be the person out on the back deck. And they're really both excellent readers, because, you know, that was one of the main activities on the boat, is you read all your library books, and then you read all your brother's library books, and then you read your mom's library books, and you read your dad's library books, and so, yeah, the reading was a really important aspect of it.
Like, were they occupied enough where you were able to help more on deck? Was that something you were interested in? Like, were you wanting to be more on deck?
Oh, I was always the deck boss.
Yeah.
That's what I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. I never wanted to steer the boat. A lot of wives and women on boats, that's kind of their main job, but I didn't enjoy it. I just wanted to be out landing fish.
Mm-hmm.
Just land fish and clean fish.
Yeah, I'd much rather be in the pit and just doing my own thing, head down. But there are these really strong gender divisions. I feel like I signed on for a life where my husband is ultimately in charge of all things boat.
Well, it's there's a built-in safety thing. When the skipper says, go do this, mm-hmm. or I need you to do that right now, you don't stop and say, but I did it last week, so it's your turn to do it now, and it's not fair, and you always, no, you just, it's safety.
Yeah. Did you find the transition to, like, deckhand to mother to be really challenging mentally, like that transition of roles?
You know, after I got to the point where I didn't, for a lot of reasons, I didn't want to physically be on the boat, you know, I wanted to be doing the shore support. And the first year, our accountant called us, and he said, I need your days at sea for doing income taxes. And I said, I didn't have any days at sea last year, you know, because you get this grocery allowance. I said, I'm shore support. I'm only like changing the oil on the boat and bottom painting and laundry and groceries and cooking casseroles and doing the books. And he goes, only? Sounds like you're the glue that's holding the operation together. And I went, well, thank you, you know.
That is nice. That's a nice reminder.
You know, when you're going through it at the time, it's like the days are long, but the years go by fast. And then when your kids are adults, they're thankful that they know how to work hard.
Mm.
And we don't get paid by the hour. You know, you get paid by the pound, and I just know that both of my sons know the value of hard work, and they know that the harder they work, the better they do. And on the boat, you're always instilling in them, you know, okay, you get this job done, you look around and see what else needs. Something always can be scrubbed.
Yeah, just instilling that in them through real life. Nowadays, I feel like I'm a pretty young mother. I'm 23 and my son's a year and a half. And I feel really good about that my son will remember the day that we pay off our boat. And that was like the first loan that my husband and I ever took out. And we did that together. We made this for ourselves.
That was Iris Nash speaking with Sarah Jordan. Their interview was produced by KCAW's Emily Russell. To see photos of the two women and their families over the years, go to our website, alaskapublic.org. Across the state, there is a cohort of young Alaskans raising awareness for the rapidly changing Arctic. Cade Tirada is one of the 22 Arctic Youth Ambassadors. Growing up in Unalaska, America's largest fishing port, he was immersed in the seafood industry. Zoe Sobel of Alaska's Energy Desk sat down with Tirada in Anchorage, where he's interning at the Alaska Center.
Cade Tirada looks like a young, hip politician. Hair gelled back, the 18-year-old sports a gray quarter zip and khakis with an earring and a tattoo peeking out from under his sleeve. He graduated from high school early, in December. You might not guess the role fishing has played in his life. Tirada's father grew up in a small town in northern Japan, and the best way to make money was fishing.
He had to drop out of school in the ninth grade because his family was quite poor at the time. So he's been, you know, working in the fishing industry ever since, which is approximately 40-plus years.
What do you think of fishing when you were a kid?
I really enjoyed it. I really, like, enjoyed looking in the tide pools with all the hermit crabs. And then I thought it was really cool just, like, looking at fish. Like, I don't know what it was about it, but it was just always, like, an exciting opportunity to see, like, what can we catch? Like, what's out there?
At what point did you realize that Unalaska was pretty unique in the amount of, I mean, it's in the Bering Sea. There's so much fish concentrated there. It's unique in the amount of resources it has.
I kind of, you know, started realizing it back when I was beginning my high school career. You know, it didn't really hit me that maybe 90% of my class has someone working in the fishing industry. My history teacher would always talk about this town would be a ghost town if we didn't have fisheries. And then it really got me thinking that everything really is dependent upon the fisheries where I'm from.
Becoming an Arctic Youth Ambassador was a stretch for Tirada. He didn't really excel in high school.
I mean, there's like a lot of other kids like me that kind of have the mindset that if they have a low GPA, they're not going to be able to do much. So, I mean, I kind of want people to know that if you have a low GPA, that doesn't mean anything. With this ambassador program, I've had, you know, the opportunity to go to Greenland, Canada. I've met Prime Minister of Canada, Justin Trudeau. I've met with countless government officials. And that's not something you'd expect from a kid with a 2.6 GPA.
Tirada has been passionate about protecting the environment for as long as he can remember. He got his start with Alaska Youth for Environmental Action. After a youth organizing summit, he was encouraged to apply for the Arctic Youth Ambassador Program. For Tirada, convincing people to care about the environment is simple. He puts it in perspective.
Well, a lot of people I meet like sushi, and I'm like, well, I come from the place that's the number one fishing port in the nation. So if you like crab, if you like, you know, eating fish, if you like any of this, you better care about the environment. People are like, wow, I really like my caviar. And if I don't care about the environment, there's going to be no more caviar or lobster.
At only 18, Tirada feels like he's already making a difference. Next up, college, where he's planning to pursue degrees in political science and environmental studies. Then he wants to return to Alaska to run for elected office. After nearly two decades living in America's largest fishing port, he thinks he'll be able to bridge the gap between science and politics and continue to advocate for his community and the environment. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Zoe Sobel in Anchorage.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugia,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This week on AK, Turkish Delights. The Republic of Turkey is about as far as you can go from Alaska. The country of nearly 80 million people straddles the edges of Europe and Asia, with a Mediterranean climate and a rich history as the seat of both the Byzantine and Ottoman empires. So not a lot of parallels with Alaska. But both places have food and dance at the center of their cultural traditions. Engin Kilich is sharpening a long knife next to a leg-sized cone of meat rotating near a flame.
Makes it sharper. Gets dull very easily.
Kilich, whose last name coincidentally means sword, is slicing thin strips of meat and heaping it onto a pillowy flatbread. It's a dish called donut, which started out as an inexpensive street food, almost like the Turkish equivalent of a hot dog truck, but has spread around the globe. The meat here is layers of beef and lamb, pressed together and marinated for a full day.
As it cooks, as you can see, like it's dripping, all that fat is dripping, so it keeps the whole meat very moist.
Kilich taught himself how to make donut out of curiosity. It's a bit of a kitchen hobby for him. He's plating the food up as part of a sold-out cultural event on a recent weekend night in Anchorage. It's an evening of food, belly dancing, and a documentary by a sociology professor.
If someone had told me 23 years ago that one day I would live in Alaska, I would never have believed it.
Professor Zeynep Kilich grew up in Ankara, but got her doctorate in the U.S. A few years ago, Kilich moved to Anchorage for a job at UAA to be closer to her brother Engin, the same amateur chef who's making donar ahead of the screening. In the film, Professor Kilich uses her own experience as an immigrant missing Turkish cuisine as a doorway into the country's phenomenally complex culinary traditions.
I just realized that my scholar self was a very critical, like food imperialism and, you know, racialization of ethnic food. And then my regular self in the kitchen was like, hi, baklava, yay, you know.
For years, Kilich would invite friends over or cook, and people would ask questions about the food she was making. So she'd give an answer.
And then there was all this like, oh my God, I'm telling people all this stuff about Turkish cuisine, but I don't know anything about it. I just know what my mom showed me, and then, you know, middle class existence in a city. And people treat as if your word is the last word, if you're the only Turkish person they know.
Kilich's film looks at restaurants and foods around Istanbul, Turkey's enormous, sprawling cultural capital. She looks at the historical and class dimensions of different foods and where they fit into the ways people come together to eat. The setting is Turkey, but it's the kind of curiosity and awareness about food that she thinks can be applied anywhere.
For me, it's not just about Turkish food. If anybody around the table can start thinking about, like, really, what does my table represent? You know, is this about me being Jewish and eating, you know, kosher food? Or is this about me being Muslim and eating halal food? Or is this about Alaskan, being Alaskan and eating the fish that I fished last summer? You know, I think that those are universal questions.
After the documentary ends, there's another round of belly dancing. In an elaborate costume with colorful swirling veils, jangling metal talismans, and flashes of bare flesh, the main dancer's hips ricochet back and forth in time with a rapid drum. It's like watching the choreography to a music video, but with muscle movements that I didn't even know existed. The performance is led by Rabia Duddy, who arrived in Anchorage a decade and a half ago after growing up and studying dance in Turkey.
It's not a burlesque. It's not a ballet. It is a truly phenomenal dance form that you become a live instrument on stage.
Like a lot of immigrants, Duddy acutely missed the things that were commonplace in her home culture. So she made a little sliver of Anatolia in Anchorage, teaching belly dance, which was a challenge. For example, figuring out how to put highly specific bodily movements into language, and a different language, no less.
Omuzatma, omuzatma, meaning, you know, shoulder shimmy, or it's the accent, shoulder accent. It took me a while.
Duddy says there's only about 50 Turks living in Anchorage, and she knows most, if not all of them. She's the one who organized the event tonight, part of an initiative she undertook just a few years ago to bring Turks together and expose more people in Alaska to Turkish culture. The night is bittersweet. It's one of the last gatherings Duddy's putting on before she and her family move out of state.
I'm not prepared. I mean, it's emotional, and I'm hoping they continue to connect with each other. I'm hoping continue to dance, and I'm hoping continue to, you know, have gatherings like this.
But for now, as guests file out and the last desserts are scraped from their trays, Duddy says she feels accomplished with how many people came to eat, learn, and watch a little belly dancing. Now it's time for 49 Voices. This week, we're hearing from Cole Tamblyn in Anchorage. Tamblyn is the head brewer at Resolution Brewing Company.
I grew up in Oregon, in kind of a small town northwest of Portland called St. Helens, Oregon. I had a friend who was from Anchorage who drove buses for Holland America, and she was like, you know what, there's a lot of jobs in Alaska in the summer, you know, if you need a summer job and you can make pretty good money. So I did that, and I fell in love with Alaska and just kind of continued to work in tourism for, yeah, most of the summers after that until I decided to come up here full time and then kind of fell in love with brewing, and now here I am. You find all sorts of people here, just like you do down there. You know, you got the Patagonia wares, the outdoorsy types. You got the, you know, the city types. But I think it's a small Alaska. Like, you run into so many people that you never, or you think you'll never see again here. There's still the people I meet every summer that are, you know, they're like, we did not know how to pack for this. Like, we have 5 coats. Like, we thought it was gonna be freezing, and like, it's one of those odd Anchorage days where it's like 80, you know, and they're like, we don't have any shorts or flip-flops or anything. So I think people still, yeah, especially the further you get away from the Northwest, people have no idea. They see pictures of mountains and like snowy peaks, and they just think it's gonna be cold all the time, which we know is not true. We get really awesome summers here. One of the most beautiful places in the country, in the world, honestly, where everything you might want to do in the winter or summer is literally just like 20 minutes away at your fingertips. And I love that part.
Cole Tamblyn lives in Anchorage. 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Dave Waldron and Wesley Early. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. Is all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we are online at alaskapublic.org. Like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media. And follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Caroline Halter, Jacob Resnick, and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Emily Russell in Sitka, and Zoe Sobel in Unalaska. Our web editor and producer tonight was Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor, and I am Zachariah Hughes. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
When you pick Click Give, you become a partner with a local nonprofit working to protect the things you love about Alaska. Whether it's the arts, our parks, or lending a hand to someone in crisis, with Pick Click Give, it's easy to find a nonprofit that shares your passion or provides programs in your neighborhood. When you apply for your PFD, say yes to sharing just $25 or more of your dividend. If you've already filed, add a donation at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by Pick Click Give.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.